Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Engaging the Phenomenon. And today we are honored and pleasured to have back on our friend, Darren King. Welcome, Darren.
Hi, James. Good to be here. Thanks for having me. I think it's my, fourth time or so?
Is it? Yeah. So at least, right? At least. Yeah. And so for everybody watching and listening, Darren is the creator of the Point of Convergence podcast. He's the co-creator of the Liminal Frames podcast and the Event Horizon podcast. He's also created a course called The Essence of Being, and he is the director of communications for the John Mack Institute. So, you know, Darren, if you're familiar with his work, does very deep dives in a very articulate way that I think if you're coming into this topic, whether you've been involved for a number of years or you're new, Darren can get into some complex ideas, but explain it in a very kind of down-to-earth or reasonable way, I would say, and can, you know, help you break down some larger, bigger picture ideas. So I would highly recommend you checking out Darren's work. And, you know, there's a number of things that I wanted to discuss with Darren today. So we're going to start off with indigestible. What is indigestible about the UFO phenomenon?
Great question. I tuned in for both of your interviews with Jim Semivan and Peter Lavanda. So I'm very familiar with that conversation and how it evolved. The general notion, just to remind people in case you didn't see the interview, is that Semivan was suggesting that when he talks to people at a higher grade than him in the IC intelligence community, he is told that this truth is indigestible. So then the question becomes, what does that mean? Now, Lavanda followed up by saying it's indigestible from a certain point of view, a certain vantage point. So what I've noticed in our community is some people immediately go, this must be bad news, must be nefarious, and we can't swallow it because it's just it's too overwhelming. Now, Lavanda went a bit further and said, well, from the military-industrial complex point of view, you're going to see it that way because they're used to breaking things down to threat or not, friend or foe, and this is just much too complex for that. And it begins to call into question some of the foundations of our model of reality, the sort of conventional model of reality, which is something I talk about a lot. You can't be in this topic for very long before you end up there asking questions about the nature of reality. I think it's one of the greatest gifts that this phenomenon is offering is an opening to a new way of seeing reality itself and touches all sorts of things, life and death and different backgrounds for different humans, those kinds of things. So it's indigestible because it is coming from a frame that eclipses our current frame, is what I would say, speaking of liminal frames. This is a frame that eclipses any particular frame we have right now. I know that Jim talked about different people with different backgrounds, different religious backgrounds. This would be completely overwhelming to them because it kind of supersedes and subsumes whatever worldview they have had, right? Is it bigger than that? It encompasses that. So in that sense, you know, it's indigestible. But on the other hand, as I was saying to you before we started recording, while I think the intelligence community and the military-industrial complex and politicians and whatnot always think it's better to kick the can down the road and we'll deal with it one day but not now, because it is going to break open some new possibility spaces for how we think about reality, it's never going to be the perfect time, right? It's never going to be. You have to ask yourself, at what point does the pro outweigh the con? We know that people like Hal Puthoff were part of these think tanks that were pulled together. Do you think disclosure is a good idea? They evaluate all these different ways that would impact our society. And he says that pretty much everybody at every table concluded after that assessment that no disclosure should not happen. It would be too disruptive to society because too many different aspects of our society would be impacted simultaneously. But when you look at what's happening in our world now, where it just seems to be unwinding and becoming less and less coherent over time, I think a shock to the system is exactly what we need. I think it's partly why we're seeing an uptick in sightings and telepathic downloads and that kind of thing. But for the powers that be, they never really think about it from that perspective. So from that perspective, this is something that is indigestible and unreleasable, but only from that perspective. That's what I would stress.
Yeah. And, I will also, want to thank Jim for, even though he has his perspective, he's coming out into the community and he's sharing his perspective. And he is doing what he is doing behind the scenes. And, so it's an interesting thing, right? Is he was impacted in a certain way by his experience, which, just as I've had positive experiences, right? I honor and respect his experience and opinion and how it affected him. So he'll say things like indigestible, but at the same time, he's in many ways helping to push the ball forward, So what do you make of that? And even somebody like Hal, right? They have their kind of intel and perspectives, but they're still have been working behind the scenes to push the ball forward on the subject.
Yeah, I think I've heard you actually mention this a couple of times, I think, since the interview. I think some of them have mixed feelings, right? On the one hand, they can understand that this is a lot, and they, I think, do, from a place of conscience, wonder if this is the right thing to do, to actually release this. But at the same time, I think it eats at them that what government has the right to say, we're going to withhold the nature of reality from the populace? At some point, you have to trust that truth is something that is our birthright, and you just have to release it. You don't want to be moving away from truth or basically forwarding a narrative that's not accurate about the ultimate nature of things. And even if that is shocking and will put us through some ontological shock, I think in the long run, it will be in our best interest. I'm one who really argues for letting things be as they really are. And I would say most of the problems, if not all of the problems in the world, individually and collectively, or because we don't live from this place of radical transparency. So I think ultimately, even though that will be disruptive, there will be a period of time where a major adjustment will have to happen. I think in the long run, it would serve us to know this. And I think these guys, inwardly feel that mixed bag of things, that they do wonder about it. They sometimes don't want to be the ones to push the button, so to speak, but the humanity in them, I think, sometimes makes them realize this is just not right to keep it in certain quarters. So I agree with you. I think that they are sharing the complicated nature of the matter. You look at someone like Hal, he's a good person, means well, wants good things for people, is not trying to withhold this out of ego or out of a sense of, I get to know it and you don't, even though David Grush has spoken about running into some people in the IC who do have that kind of perspective. But not all of the guys who are holding this back are doing it for egotistical reasons. Some of them really do wonder about the impacts. And I'm not downplaying that there will be impacts. It will be disruptive. But I think in the long run, it will serve us. And I'm glad that those guys are doing whatever they are doing to help push it forward.
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize that, Jim and Hal and those guys, they do have NDAs, and there are legal and otherwise consequences for them just saying like, "Hey guys, I'm going to tell you everything." They can't do that, and I don't think it's fair to expect them to. And I would even say, Lou Elizondo gets a lot of crap. But there's no reason that Lou had to do anything that he did, right? He could have just kept his stressful but very cushy and well-paying job and stayed away from all this and continued on with his life. But he disrupted everything he was doing to participate in this conversation, make a change. So I do also want to respect that, and so there's that too, and it makes things complicated. But ultimately, because of everybody on that level participating the way they are, we're in a different conversation now. But I, Darren, you mentioned a few things, and I want to kind of get into this aspect of the phenomenon, which involves interpretation and perspective. But I want to preface that a little and say like, hey, everybody listening and watching, we're not trying to tell you to look at the phenomenon or your experience in a certain way. We're not saying we're right, you're wrong, none of that. What we're doing is we're having a conversation in a way to broaden your aperture and your perception and your maybe your frame of thinking or train of thought in a way where you can we can work with each other to see the phenomenon in different ways. So I just want to preface the conversation in saying that and say, you know, Darren, what role does perception and integration have to do with the phenomenon, whether there's somebody who's a firsthand experiencer who had maybe a traumatic experience, maybe a positive experience, or somebody who doesn't know anything about this may be strongly religious and they come across this information and automatically jump to the assumption of angelic or demonic. I know that there's kind of a lot there to break down, but to give people kind of like a wide range of possibility when it comes to the phenomenon.
Right. That is a lot to break down, but I'll say a few things. One thing to be aware of that I think people underestimate frequently is the role that the individual plays, or the organization for that matter, in interpreting data. So one of the things I talk a lot about on Point of Conversions and Liminal Frames is how you can't separate those two. And we both know that different aspects of government have massive amounts of data, but how you interpret that data is an entirely different question. And people sometimes forget that because this is a different intelligence, it's non-human, some of it may be non-conventionally human, but it does interact differently. It works with time differently. These kinds of things might be coming outside of space-time because space-time itself, even our cutting-edge physics is seeing kind of the shadow of some deeper structure, and some of these beings undoubtedly seem to be coming from that structure or aware of that structure, working from that structure. So you have to keep in mind your own interpretive grid, that's always part of the process. And so when you're looking to government for answers, and we specifically mean there the defense industry, right? The military industrial complex, this isn't to just paint it with one brush and say it's all negative. But it is to say that they have a certain way of assessing things as threats. That's how they make their living. That's what the business they're in generally. So that's going to, again, reduce the possibilities to friend or foe, again, threat or not. One of the interesting things is even when you look back at the 20th century, how often different groups, the Air Force and whatnot, would actually release information amongst themselves saying, this doesn't appear to be a threat. We see it. It's doing things, but doesn't appear to be a threat. I notice some people jump in and say, well, they're showing up at our nuclear weapons facilities. That sounds like they're basically trying to assess our capabilities before, you know, some sort of invasion happens. I think to people like you and I, very familiar with the sophisticated nature of this intelligence and the way that it can manipulate space-time itself, as well as the perception of individuals, the notion that it would have to sort of follow that traditional way of, you know, flanking your opponent before making a move is kind of silly, actually. I'm not saying I therefore know it's for positive reasons either, but I think we need to just keep the questions open, not lead to conclusions. The other thing is, too, each of us has a history. You know, so each of the people that we just mentioned, right, have a certain history. And that history will also frame how we see things. It's just the way reality works. We are wired so that experience helps us predict what our next experience will be. That's how we learn, and we take shortcuts. We, out of necessity, need to develop these shortcuts because there's just too much information to take in if we were to just sit back and absorb it at all. So we create these buckets based on our previous experience, and that's going to determine the possibilities for our future experience. This phenomenon is wide-ranging. It sort of covers a spectrum of consciousness, so it doesn't fit easily in any of those buckets. So these are some of the things we need to be aware of. The last thing I'll say in terms of the religious framing, so there's a perfect example. Some people get frustrated that people leap to this, it's angels or demons, and they usually leap to it's demons. But when you've been propagandized or brainwashed or brought up in an environment that repeatedly tells you all there is sort of the earthly realm, and then these spiritual realms, one of darkness, one of light, heaven, hell, that kind of thing, then that becomes your map. And you lose the ability to even recognize there's a map. You sort of take it for reality. So confusing the map for the territory. And we shouldn't, I think, be too critical of these people. They're doing the best they can. They're not deliberately trying to obfuscate. This is the way they've been taught to see the world. But we want to encourage them in dialogue to open up the possibility space, that any of our pre-existing notions about reality, like again, even metaphysical reality, it calls into question because of the nature of this data. So let's stand back. Let's open the dialogue. Let's ask questions together and do it peaceably.
Yeah. And so to kind of add on to all of that, yeah, I mean, you got into it a little. People will often say there's a kind of reflective nature to the phenomenon. Maybe, and here's the question too, right? Is part of that is interpretation, but I think some people are also saying that maybe our beliefs have a way of kind of interacting or influencing the way the interactions occur as well. So what do you think about that aspect?
Yeah, that's a really key aspect to take into consideration too. And I know this might seem overwhelming to people to think about that too. We're trying to assess the nature of the phenomenon and is it friend or foe? It's more complex than that. But in addition, yes, we play a role in this too. Now, this again gets into metaphysical matters because it begins to raise questions around who are we, right? I often say in my podcast that we are impressions, fractal impressions of source consciousness. I think when you start seeing things from that perspective, some of this starts to make sense because you kind of get this echoing back of source to source and you notice some of this. The other thing is this is happening very often in subtle realms. And so any kind of predisposition you have is going to filter into that in a pretty substantial way, more than happens in this sort of particular modulation of consciousness that we call our waking state reality. So even when you're going to do psychedelics, or you're going to do meditation, or you're going to do lucid dreaming, going to do breath work, any kind of experience where you're trying to induce a non-ordinary state, you want to be aware of your own energetic makeup going in because it will filter into it. So if to give people an example, they can probably grab onto you. Many people probably have had the experience of having negative residual energy in their body because of something that happened with a coworker or a spouse or something. Somebody cut you off in traffic. Then you end up having a negative dream. And that is an example where one sort of seeds the other. This can happen in this space too. And we see this not just in things like dreams and meditation, but even in places like Skinwalker Ranch, there seems to be this notion of this reflective nature. Another example that I would point to that's really compelling is Dorothy Izett. Now, those of you not familiar with her, I would totally recommend you look her up. I did a couple podcast episodes on her. Fascinating accounts where she's documented with footage, amazing sights in the sky, not just lights, but shapes and impressions, beings, those kinds of things, and more probably than anybody else in the history of the world. And what's interesting with her is that she had a very innocent, trusting nature to her, and her experiences were positive. Then there was a point of time, to tie in an earlier part of what we talked about, that she went to her church, and people around her church started saying, this sounds satanic. You know, if you're seeing beings and not human, then it's got to be a satanic deception. And then she went home, and she actually started seeing kind of negative entities begin to manifest that would show up as kind of like shadowy kind of things. And she would pick up this vibration, this sense that they were malevolent. Then she caught herself and said, what am I doing believing this malevolent kind of thinking? Turned back to her natural state, which was benevolent, was positive, was trusting, and then began to have the positive experiences and had those ongoingly. So I think she's a really good case in point of how we play a role in seeding the nature of these experiences.
Yeah. And again, for people watching and listening, I would recommend that you watch Darren's episodes dealing with Dorothy Izett. And also there was a documentary called Capturing the Light. And the book Darren, do you recall the name of the book? It was like,
like Behold the Beings of Light or Beings of Light or something.
It was Beings of Light, but it was like Communication with Beings of Light. It was a similar title, but not exactly the same. Right. But if you look Dorothy Izett up on Amazon, both the book and the documentary are going to come up. And I again, absolutely a great example of an experience or case, and which demonstrates that kind of interactive quality that occurs during contact with non-human intelligence. So, Darren, you know, some of these things you mentioned here, I'm gonna put a question to that, and you addressed this in the course that you have, The Essence of Being. I'm not sure if you're still putting them on, and I believe you are. So, what does the cultivation of human potential and consciousness have to do with UFOs and non-human intelligence?
That's a great question. That's the question I want people to get to. Because what's interesting is, while we sometimes hear people trying to assess, is this a threat? How much of a threat is it? What we actually see when we look at, for instance, the survey that was done by the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation, which is now CCRI, we're both very familiar with this. The vast majority of experiences there were reported as either neutral or positive. And interestingly, over time, with additional perspective and time to sort of integrate the experience, they skewed more and more positive. That isn't to say that there aren't experiences that are negative. I'm not going to suggest, and neither would you, I don't think, that anybody who had a negative experience just hasn't integrated it enough yet.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's a range of experiences. We need to allow for that. It's a spectrum, just like when you step outside your front door. It's silly to assume it's all going to be benevolent or it's all going to be malevolent. You're going to have a mix. And I think we see this spectrum of consciousness development in humankind that's really interesting. So part of my background in integral theory and spiral dynamics is recognizing how there's this predictable spiraling up of consciousness that sees things as more and more connected over time and keeps expanding the sense of the sphere of care and concern. And not only is that true for humankind, and you can see it both as individuals and as cultures around the world, where you could go in and you could take a measure of the center of gravity of where they're at as a consciousness, as a collective, and you can pretty much predict where they're going to go next because these things happen. There's an emergent property to consciousness, which is really fascinating. I would say that that's us being drawn back to source, sort of remembering who we are. And that's also true, I would suggest, for these different beings. This is kind of like the cosmic default. So we should expect that. And on that note, the most positive beings, the most benevolent, the most ascendant of these beings, as I call them, generally do that. They're not egotistical. They're not into power plays. They're not into domination. Whenever you hear about those kinds of elements, there's a good sign that that's a kind of being that's operating at a lower level of consciousness. Once you move towards non-duality, recognizing that everything's connected and ultimately everything is reflections of each other, then your sense of self-interest completely changes. So not only do we see this with these different kinds of beings, again, along the spectrum, but we see this with human beings as well. And what is really on the table here is a possibility, I think, most overarchingly and most importantly, is a new world if we can take it, some of the beings sometimes say. Which means we fundamentally change our understanding of ourselves, our relationship with each other, moving beyond this scarcity mentality, beyond this sense of having this adversarial kind of nature, because that's slowly killing us. And also in terms of our relationship with the planet. So the most benevolent of these beings, I'm not saying they're all that way, but the ones that are that way are encouraging that. They're encouraging us to step into who we are, step into our power, sort of accept that birthright. You know, embody that birthright that we all have as fractals of source consciousness. So again, this is why I think it comes down to metaphysical matters more than anything else. And if we reduce it to this lens of, is it friend or foe? Is it potentially dangerous? As Lavinda said, it can be dangerous without being hostile, sometimes just incidentally. But we don't want to let that fight or flight, low-level kind of thinking make us miss this opportunity for what is on the table here. Something remarkable is happening, where the amount of contact, the amount of telepathic downloads people are receiving that basically are encouraging these kinds of notions is overwhelming. And I was telling you that I recently held this group where we talked about our experiences. And there was a group of people, very different kinds of experiences, everything from abduction experiences to psychedelic journeys to people who had dream state experiences, but all interacting with different kinds of beings. And most interestingly, the number one sort of ground level consensus we had was that we as human beings don't understand our potential. We don't understand how our sense of ourselves, this illusion of separation, is what's actually causing all the conflict in the world. And everybody, even though they encountered different kinds of beings and through different kinds of modalities, all wanted to see a new world and are asking the questions now, how do we get there? So this is all wrapped up together. Our potential as humanity, our potential as just cosmic citizens, denizens. And again, we see the spiraling of consciousness, both in human development, and I would argue in some of these other beings as well.
And what do you make of the accounts of and reports of people that have a UFO experience, that have a close encounter, that have an interaction with non-human intelligence, you know, whether it's through a contact modality, a random occurrence, or even a near-death experience, and they're interacting with entities, or even people maybe are using other means and having interactions with non-human intelligence. And then they come out of that experience of a UFO encounter, and they have this almost like a psychic perception come online.
Yeah, that again, it is fascinating because it prompts all sorts of questions. Is there something unique about these people from birth? Is it something that happens after they've had one of these experiences, that these beings somehow turn something on, or being exposed to a certain element of reality sort of activates some dormant potential that maybe we all have? We just haven't all had the opportunity to have it turned on. These are interesting questions. As you know, there's some really interesting research being done now, Gary Nolan and whatnot, looking at biosignatures, looking at differences in the brains of experiencers versus not. There's all sorts of really interesting research being done around neurodivergence and how does that play into this. There's overlap there for sure. I know that my background, I have, you know, a few things that I think would fall in that pattern. And it also comes from my dad's side. And he's also had experiences, as I've had experiences, more so than my mom has had. So that tells me there is something to it. There's something genetic about it. We have to remember this, that one of the most compelling aspects of the data is that people come back from these experiences and they are changed. They are more psychic, like you said. And for those of you maybe not so familiar with this, I would just suggest that, you know, if you are not sold on this idea, go research Dean Radin's work, and you'll find that this has been demonstrated time and time again, that psi is real. Now, somehow psi overlaps with all of this. One of the most fascinating aspects is that when we have communication with these beings, all these different kinds of beings that I think are coming from different origin sources, we find that we can telepathically communicate with all of them. And then on top of that, we have evidence that human beings can telepathically communicate with each other. There's something about this that's really fascinating. I think that what it's showing again is what I was saying earlier. This is like the cosmic default, that we are all fractals of the same thing, mirroring each other. And this is why we can have this kind of telepathic contact. And that any of the borders and the boundaries that we put around us are largely illusory. They're porous. So that means we can perceive through things because we actually are all one thing. And so sometimes we limit our own ability and our own potential by our thoughts, right? This is really interesting how much this overlaps with, you think about the raw contact material, these different channeled materials to do with these kinds of beings. And they talk about that, that you are like dancing thought. And because, again, not only is there a reflective nature to the experiences themselves, but there's a reflective nature to how reality basically manifests. I would say that we are collectively, you know, manifesting one reality over another collectively based on the combination of all the ways that we interact with reality. So this aspect goes from the very beginning to the very end, and it covers sort of every element and every different stage. So what I've noticed myself, and I'm sure you've noticed as well, is since I had these kind of contact experiences, I've talked about, for instance, when I was at the Monroe Institute for a private retreat a couple of years ago, we saw things in the sky, which is interesting, but the most interesting aspect for me was the telepathic communication I received afterwards, which was ongoing and has continued since then. And just like you, it's my experience has been very benevolent, very positive. It's basically trying to take my the best parts of me and try to prop those up and encourage more of that. And in fact, Essence of Being, which is all about human potential, was basically inspired by those kinds of experiences and that kind of communication. So there is a genetic aspect to this somehow, but I think fundamentally, because of the nature of reality, because of the metaphysical underpinning, everyone has these capacities. In fact, again, Radin would say this, that when they try to create a control group that they can test against, it's very difficult to find people that don't have some sort of psychic capacity. That seems to be turned up, turned on by these interactions. And like you pointed out, it doesn't necessarily have to be an abduction experience or an encounter with an alien. It can be a near-death experience. We have people who have a near-death experience and come back and suddenly have precognitive dreams. So something gets opened up, the aperture gets expanded, and then we seem to be able to stay in that enlightened, expanded state afterwards. Again, that, I think, bodes a lot of promise for our future in terms of human potential in the world to come, if we could all sort of step into that, step away from this divisiveness, step away from the illusion of separation, begin to dream together, use our imagination to expand into this possibility space. And lastly, I'll just say, when we reduce this to narrative structures and threat narrative structures, we lose all of that potential. And there are some groups, both human groups, I would say, and some maybe not so benevolent NHI, that would like us to stay in that place of being stuck and not expanded. So we need to ask ourselves, what is our birthright and how are we going to step into it?
And, you know, with all that said, I hate to pin this question on you, Darren, but I got to ask you, because you do such a great job of navigating these conversations, is what do you say to people who say, you know, all positive experiences, that's just a manipulation, and the non-human intelligence is just making you feel that it's positive, but it's actually negative in some way?
Right. So I would come back, first of all, to what I said earlier about we have experience in life, and this teaches us what to expect in future experiences. So if we have had the experience of being manipulated, being used, people saying one thing and doing another, all of those experiences frame reality for us. And without us being conscious of it, we start assuming that is what's going to happen. That's the only possibility, basically. It's very interesting how, like in my case, I did not come from a traumatic background. I had a loving family. I did not feel generally manipulated by people. And so I have sort of an open-ended, open-minded, open-hearted way of dealing with reality. And I think that changes my experiences to some degree. So first thing we need to be aware of is, again, we will to some degree find what we're looking for. So if you're going into one of these experiences and they are ontologically shocking, right? So what that means is that our biological, evolutionarily derived physiology is going to react with fight or flight sometimes just because of the ontological shock. I've met many people who now view their experiences as very positive, very benevolent, and they are thankful for how it cracked them open and exposed them to a much more expansive worldview. But it wasn't all fun and games getting there. That ego death can feel very, very overwhelming, and it can feel like a threat. It can feel malevolent when it's actually not. That cracking open is necessary to reach that potential, but it can be an overwhelming experience. But we have to be careful not to assume that fight or flight response that comes online is somehow indicative or descriptive of what the actual experience holds as its potential. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is to separate the difference between the physiological, learned, evolutionarily derived response and what it can open us up into. I can think again of Whitley Strieber talks about this. He talks pretty plainly about some of the experiences being very traumatic initially, but he also says he feels like this collection of experiences holds the greatest potential for spiritual transformation in the history of the world for humankind. So I really want people to hold both of those things in their awareness, not just go to one or the other. It is ontologically shocking. It is overwhelming. It makes you feel like you're going to die sometimes. Your old worldview will die, but it will give birth to something much more expansive, which we need, by the way, to sort of navigate the space we're in as a collective. The other thing to say, too, is that we live in a very cerebral kind of culture in Western civilization. So we're used to thinking things through. We're used to attaching our ideas of reality to reference points. And so we have, for a long time, not been very much in our bodies, not somatically grounded, not integrated in our bodies. So we can have experiences and immediately go to our minds to try to figure out if that is a good experience or not. And I think we underestimate the degree to which, when we have cultivated this deep inner awareness in our bodies, we can trust the experience we get when we encounter one of these beings. And if you are sensing benevolence, love, again, that connection across a divide that is largely illusory because you're part of the same thing, that is real. It's when we go through the mind and the cerebral process that we sometimes get hijacked into trying to think about it. But that direct bodily experience that is that feeling of love that many of us have experienced with another, when you think about that, it's not primarily a cerebral experience. It's in your body. There's a heart wisdom that kind of comes in there. For those of us who've had positive experience with those beings, that's what we experience. It's not they do certain things, we weigh the pros and cons and go, I think that was positive. We deeply know it in our bodies, and that's a kind of awareness that we need to cultivate as part of our human potential.
And, you know, assuming that there are different, let's say there's a variety of non-human intelligences, and, I don't want to oversimplify it or make it sound new age or what, you know, whatever you want to call it. But let's assume that there's non-human entities and intelligences that are primarily, you know, they're biological like us. Let's say that there's some on different levels. Maybe we would call them a light entity, right? I don't know exactly how that pairs them up in physical reality, but let's just say there's a variety of non-human intelligence. Does who you are or like your state of being, your state of thinking, potentially attract or invite different entities of a different variety?
It does. And this comes back to what we're talking about. I hope people are noticing an overarching theme here, that because everything's connected, the illusion of separation makes us feel like we're independent entities. We're actually not ultimately. And so we are seeding the field, I would say, in many, many different kinds of ways. So again, this means we have more power than we realize, but we can also be our own enemy kind of thing sometimes. And again, when we're trapped in our minds, we are sometimes out of touch with what we're actually sort of bleeding into the field in terms of an energetic signature. So for instance, if you're someone with a lot of fear or a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, and you haven't processed that, you haven't done your shadow work, those kinds of things, then even if you are holding on to the idea, I want a positive encounter, but that is actually what's leaking into the field, it's going to surprise you. And again, will make you double down on the idea, actually, these things are negative and these are not positive experiences. So we absolutely need to be aware of all the different ways that we play a role in this. We really do have the opportunity to manifest one reality over another on a mass scale. And this really comes down to consciousness being primary. So this is one of the metaphysical aspects that becomes clear with this, is that, again, one of the common denominators in all these experiences is how the more benevolent ones point to this, that consciousness is primary, that we are all fractals of source consciousness. Basically, we are each other, and we encounter that with each other. So when you look into non-dual traditions, you get some of the exact same messages you get from some of these beings. And it's also the kind of revelations we're finding in quantum mechanical experiments, too, that we find that when we try to break things down into smaller and smaller parts and analyze there, things start getting blurry and things are no longer precise. They're no longer one thing or another. It's more like a field of undifferentiation that takes on certain manifestation when consciousness interacts with it. which when you flip that around, ultimately means everything's just one. And only from a certain perspective do we have the illusion of separation, which is meaningful, and it helps us grow because it puts catalysts in our life, the experiences that we need to ground and integrate to learn and grow, and we feed that back to source consciousness, on it goes. If people think this is, you know, kind of spiritualizing or making a new age message out of the phenomenon, this is just the nature of reality, I would say. And we're seeing in all these different converging fields of data, near-death experience, out-of-body experience, encounters with apparitions, encounters with deceased loved ones, encounters with the beings, right? All these different kinds of beings. And not surprisingly, because some of these beings recognize that some of these borders, these boundaries are illusory. That's why we sometimes have beings showing up with our deceased loved ones, that basically our limitation is in our ability to perceive reality. It's not something fundamental about reality. So there's a lot to expand into here, but I really want to encourage people to think about your resonance determines what you harmonize with. So if you have a positive, loving, connected kind of resonance, that's what you're going to harmonize with. I like to say sometimes that determines who picks up on the other line. So in any kind of these experiences, CE5, heist, lucid dreaming, you know, any kind of contact modality you want to use, you want to be aware of this fundamentally. And basically, we're being dumbed down, I think, to not pay attention to those things. And that's also purposeful. So again, the possibility here is amazing. It's astounding. It does promise a new world. And even if disclosure is disruptive, my hope is that if it happens, it will actually further that kind of possibility.
Yeah. And I do want to pivot here a bit and get to matters that most people can identify with on a consensus level. Just, I mean, because we have to bridge the two, right? I don't expect somebody to listen to this podcast and they're going to wake up tomorrow and have like a complete awakening and just into non-duality, right? I think often people need a bridge, a stepladder. You know, they have to tread their path. They have to have their own journey to have these kind of realizations for it to really sink, right? For it, the experience and the perception to be embodied, for that kind of realization, right? That, you know, somebody might call self-realization or self-actualization. I think that it's helpful to kind of contextualize the conversations by bringing it also to, okay, so, you know, we have all this going on with, say, non-duality and some of these higher aspects, but what does that have to do with crash retrievals and the recovery of non-human occupants and UFO crashes let's say the disclosure transparency narrative, and I can say kind of the more immediate UFO Twitter, UFO X dialogue of trying to get transparency on these matters, but there's also a very physical element to it of different entities visiting us and we're trying to get disclosure about it.
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, we want to begin with the largest frame possible and think about our waking state reality, what we call consensus reality, as being one particular configuration of consciousness. So if everything's consciousness, then our shared waking state is one kind of dreamscape, if you will. And the first thing I think we need to overcome is the notion that this is somehow more substantial, more real than some of these other realms of reality or states of consciousness we can be in. I don't think it is. I think this is just one more. That means that we have beings that most often populate into different sort of frequency bandwidth kind of thing, if you want to look at it that way. So some beings can only interact with us in a dream state or when we're on hallucinogenics because it creates a modulation in our consciousness that allows them to meet up with us. Other beings do seem to be able to cross across these borders because, again, they're porous. So we think about some of these grays, for instance, that can retrieve our loved ones that have died apparently but are still around somehow and bring them there. There are some beings that are fully physical, some that are quasi-physical, some that are purely energetic. So that's one thing to think about is that there are many different kinds of reality spaces. I'm not talking about different physical universes like in a multiverse. I'm talking about just if you realize that everything is consciousness fundamentally, then just different configurations of consciousness is what we have. And our waking state reality is just one particular one. Now, what's interesting about that is that when we think about the crash retrievals, there are some interesting elements that come in there. One is the possibility of the extratempestrial model that my friend Mike Masters coined, or at least fully developed more. The notion that they may be physical and interacting with us and therefore tangible in our physical reality because they may somehow be us. They may be neo-humans, as I like to call them, from the future. Mike's done some great work showing how when you just take the current evolutionary trends that we're operating under now and you just march those out, you will eventually end up with something that looks like a gray alien just by the trends we can see evidenced in human society now. So that should give us pause, right? One of the ongoing interesting questions is why we have so many of these humanoid shapes, these humanoid forms that show up, these bipedal forms that show up time and time again. It may be, again, in this really physical way, that is because they are somehow us. They've been spliced together with other genomes, sometimes from planet Earth. And if you have enough time, some of them might also be extraterrestrial now, living on other planets, but still interacting with us. And so I think those are fully physical beings. We also need to keep in mind, of course, the revelation we're having in our own time around AI and robotics. So some of these beings, some people call biobots, some of the recovery seems to be deliberate sometimes. Sometimes it seems to be seeded or a gifting field kind of thing, as it's been referred to, where maybe not only the craft are meant to be gifts, but maybe even the beings that are recovered as well. So we are seeing in our own time that we're moving towards sort of transhumanism, where we sort of blend ourselves in kind of a cyborg nature between robotics and AI and human physiology. They may be a much further, evidence of that, and that they basically are organic, but engineered kind of life forms, some of them. And there seems to be absolutely so much evidence in the lore that these crashes have happened, and not even that rarely. There's been quite a few crashes, and that it's very clear that they have been recovered and then funneled into the defense industry to try to study these things. I just want to point out to people that that's not the entirety, though. So there is something going on, and some of them might be extraterrestrial. Some of them might be something that we just don't have a frame for yet, but they do manage to show up in our physical reality. Even there, though, I want to point out that I know people who were the abductees from the 90s that John worked with. Sometime these physical beings would show up and get up on their bed and they can feel their mattress depressed. So that's when the ontological shock hits you. This is not a dream. This is real. How did they just come through my wall? But again, these physical beings sometimes will take a person with their body on board a craft and do various things. Other times the body stays in the bed and just the consciousness of the person is taken on board the craft. And they have both of these experiences, which fundamentally should tell us that some of our, again, our categories, our assumptions are insufficient to understand reality. So where we draw this line around physical or not is tricky. But I just want to point out that this is just one of many, many different kinds of beings that are experienced across many different modalities that are coming from different origin sources. I would say that's kind of the way we paint the largest picture. And what we're focused on with ufology a lot is a narrow bandwidth of ones that we know that the military-industrial complex has interacted with, where we have these bodies and these crash retrievals. But that's just sort of the gateway drug into a much larger bandwidth and landscape involving many, many different kinds of beings and different kinds of realityscapes.
Yeah, and to complicate issues more.
Why not?
What do you make of the idea of hybrids or you know, the idea that some form of non-human intelligence has interacted with our DNA, at least in some way.
Yeah, each of these questions is like a 7-hour discussion.
I know.
How much you can get into, but I'll say a few things. One is reflecting on what I said earlier. We are seeing now research being done genetically, looking at biosignatures, looking at some different structures in people's brains for experiencers. I mentioned already we're seeing an overlap with neurodivergence and experiencers and abilities to perceive a broader spectrum of reality than other people. Of course, what's interesting about that is that neurodivergence, you could argue, is just better recognized now than it used to be, but you could also make the argument that it's much more prevalent than it used to be, even a couple of generations ago. So that prompts certain questions around, could that be a kind of genetic engineering that's happening in our midst? And while at first many people that are neurodivergent were kind of slanted as being less than and not having certain capacities that quote-unquote normal people or neurotypical people do, we are actually finding now that they have some real gifts and some almost like superpowers that can come online too. So it's, you do a sort of a trade. You lose some things, but you gain some other things. And this might be a kind of pruning that's happening at a genetic level across the entire species. One of the interesting questions that arises around the abduction phenomenon is it a limited set of people, or actually is it perhaps a vast enterprise and just not that many people remember the experiences? It could very well be the case. Either way, you could argue that we've seen shifts even in our own DNA over the last few generations that could hint at that kind of genetic manipulation, which might have to do with something that's coming, right? Preparing humanity for a certain kind of new reality where those kind of skills are necessary to navigate better. We also, of course, as you know, have interesting questions about human history and this leap that kind of happened at some point in our cognitive capacity that seems difficult to explain through normal Darwinian evolution in terms of the kind of capacities that came online in a very short period of time that doesn't really fit with the way things were supposedly supposed to happen under Darwinian evolution. So that could very well point to some sort of genetic augmentation that happened. Now, this is one of the interesting things when you start recognizing that you look at human history and deep human history, even prehistory, you see evidence of these kinds of beings that sometimes are depicted a certain way in religious scriptures, sometimes in another way as fairy lore, and then another way in the more modern UFO phenomenon. Again, I don't want to reduce those all to one kind of entity. I think there's many kinds. But I think what is clear is that they've been here all along. And so once you're aware of that and the sophistication they employ, then it inevitably leads to questions around, could we be an engineered species? And I remember when I had my conversation with Bernardo Castro, he basically made that argument that as unlikely and as outlandish as that seems to the mainstream, that's actually less of a stretch than the notion that we just rose up through Darwinian processes and became what we are today.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to remind people, you know, or question, you know, show me a religion that doesn't describe interaction with non-human intelligence and its basis, right? The majority of religions in some way are communicating the idea that we do or we have interacted with non-human intelligences in our history. It's, you know, the majority of religions are saying that. Which is interesting. And the idea that we spontaneously evolved, I mean, there's some really interesting work on that I would actually recommend that people check out by Greg Braden called Human by Design. And, you know, he's written some articles on it. He wrote a whole book on it, and he's done lectures on it. And the one point about that is extremely interesting that even very recent peer-reviewed journals of science are all stating that if you know, they're saying it in lesser words and trying to accredit it to a number of scientists instead of one person so it doesn't fall on one person, and they don't all want to individually say it. But it looks like if you look at our DNA, somewhere when we became what's known as anatomically modern humans is the term. 200,000 years ago, we spontaneously had two chromosomes augmented. To have one of them augment would be tremendous, but we had two of them simultaneously augment. And if you look at that part of the DNA, and this is all explained in the lectures and the books and what have you, and again, it's backed by actual science that is not being openly shared and adopted, even though there it is that if you look at that part of the DNA, it actually looks like what we would consider now as CRISPR. It looks like the gene's been edited. Looking at it now, you know, of course, like 30 years ago, we wouldn't know what CRISPR is, right? But knowing that now and looking at the data, there's really interesting points there. You know, we're coming to head here, Darren. You know, with all these things, well, we have like, you know, this whole theme of non-duality, consciousness, kind of our method or level of participation, not just with human intelligence, but with reality itself, right? In this whole kind of ongoing theater of consciousness, what would you leave people with to consider that is hopeful and empowering for them on this journey?
Well, I would say that, as I said before, I like to use this metaphor that the UFO phenomenon is like a gateway drug. What's fascinating to me is how I began this little podcast, which became three podcasts and a whole teaching initiative as well, just interested in UFOs. But of course, my background has also been interested in consciousness and how consciousness emerges into these more complex forms, again, spiraling up towards something, almost like something's drawing something into the future, more than some of its parts, in other words. What's fascinating to me is that when I began to offer these classes, and by the way, to answer your earlier question, I am going to teach two classes this coming fall in September. Expanding Awareness is the first class that people take, and then once they've taken that, there'll be a second class called Cosmic Awakening, but both will be available in September. What's fascinating to me is that because when you look into ufology in depth and you have an open mind and an open heart, you inevitably end up around this question of consciousness. And what's fascinating to me is how many people that are taking my courses that are most overarchingly interested in consciousness came that way through UFOs. So it begins with this kind of sci-fi, technological, interesting notion of beings coming from other star systems in nuts and bolts craft to suddenly questions around the nature of reality and who we are. So this is something I really encourage people with finally, is that this entire endeavor is not just about who they are, what they are, where they're coming from, but who we are, where we come from. These are just as fascinating questions. And if we can pivot and really leverage that line of inquiry, I think that is exactly what will take us to the new world we're hoping for and that we need based on the way things are going right now.
Yeah, and even like on a UFO level, I mean, the guy who was funding, you know, or, you know, who participated in OSAP, right, Robert Bigelow, had, you know, here he's investigating UFOs, and now we have, you know, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. So you see this kind of evolution and perception and mode of thinking time and time again in the work of many people. So that, you know, again, just something to consider. And this is, you're talking about somebody who had deep access, who had the top investigators looking at things or coming to the same kind of conclusions. So again, I'm going to have all of Darren's links in the description. I highly recommend you check out his work, and we will speak to you all soon. Thank you for being on, Darren.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it.